All right. So, again, in the Lotus Sutra, we have the parable, another parable. The sutra, as I said this morning, is full of parables and similes. This parable occurs in chapter 3. It's the parable of the burning house or the house on fire. Once again, I'm not going to recount this parable in a great in a lot of detail, because it is one of the excerpts that we will be looking at more closely tomorrow. So we will have occasion tomorrow to look at it in more detail, but I will briefly tell you what the parable is about and what the point of the parable is. And as I just said, this parable expresses the Mahayana view of the reason for and the purpose of the three vehicles. Yesterday, when I was talking about the Sarvastivada evolution of a kind of bodhisattva ideal, of a prototype or progenitor of the bodhisattva ideal, I mentioned that they talked in their Abhidhamma treatises about the three vehicles or the three yanas. And the three are, of course, the Shravaka yana, the Pratyeka Buddha yana, and the Bodhisattva yana. Now, I don't know how familiar you are with the first of these terms, Shravaka, Shravaka yana. Shravaka is, for all intents and purposes, it's a synonym of arhat. Shravaka means one who listens, who achieves liberation through listening. The shravakas, the arhats, listen to the teaching of the Buddha and achieve liberation in that way. So the vehicle of the shravakas, the vehicle of the arhats, sometimes you'll see it translated, the vehicle of the disciples. This is the first of the three vehicles. The second vehicle is the vehicle of the Pratyeka Buddha, the private Buddha or solitary Buddha. And the last vehicle is the vehicle of the Bodhisattva or the Bodhisattva Yana. Now, the parable of the burning house runs something like this. There was a very wealthy old man who had an old, very large old house. And this old house was very large and very richly furnished, but it was very old and it was badly maintained. It was decrepit, the pillars were rotted, there were a lot of structural faults in the house. And moreover, the house had only one narrow door. Now, one day, the old man, who had many children, he realizes that the house has caught fire, that the house is on fire, and that his children are inside the house at play, playing with their toys, distracted by their games. And so the father is, of course, very worried. How is he going to get his children out of this burning house before it collapses and they are all consumed, all burned by the flames? So the father thinks of various alternatives. First he tries to call out to his children. He tries to tell them, children, listen to me. The house is on fire. You are in great danger. Come out of the house at once. Leave your play. Leave your toys. Leave your games. Come out of the house right away. The house is on fire. You're all going to be killed. The fire is going to destroy you. But his children are busy with their games, and moreover, they don't understand what it means, the meaning of the fact, the meaning of the words, the house is on fire. They don't understand the meaning. They don't understand the danger. And so they don't listen. They carry on with their games. They carry on with their play. And so the father is, of course, more and more preoccupied, and he thinks, how can I get my children out of this house? And he thinks, well, I am strong. I'm still very healthy. Perhaps I can carry them out. But then he realizes that the house has only one narrow door, and that he will never be able to carry out all his children. So that is not a possible solution. So then he thinks, well, I had better come up with some device, some expedient means to get my children out of the house. And he thinks to himself, I know what my children like. I know what they are interested in. They're interested in toys. They're interested in carts. They're interested in carriages. Not surprising, just today also, young people are interested in motorcycles, interested in cars. I think this has always been the case. And so the father calls out to his children. He says, children, I know you've all been wanting various kinds of carriages, various kinds of carts. Look, I've brought you various carts. I've brought you goat carts. I've brought you deer carts. I've brought you bullock carts, ox carts. All of these carts are here. They're all standing here outside the house. Come out of the house and select whichever cart you want, whichever carriage you want. You come out of the house right away. Otherwise, these carts may go. Maybe they will take back the cars. You will miss your opportunity of getting one of these carriages. So when the children hear him call out in this way, they all abandon their little toys and their games, and they all rush out of the house to see the carriages. And once they've all come out of the house, the father is greatly relieved, and he sits down and he thinks, ah, well, at least now I have managed to save my children. They're all out of the house. And then at that point, his children come up to him and say, Daddy, Daddy, where are the carts? Where are the carriages that you promised us? And at that point, because this old man is very wealthy and he has unlimited wealth and he has a great store, great many warehouses and many, many carriages are stored there. And so he gives all of his children the best possible carriage, gives each of them the best possible carriage, the ox carriage drawn by powerful oxes, the carriages all adorned with gold and pearls and ornaments of silver and so forth. And he gives each and every one of his children the very best carts, not goat carts, not deer carts, but oxen carts, the very richest and the very best, and all the same. And the children are very happy, and they all drive off in their carriages in different directions, delighted with their acquisition. And the moral of the story is, the house, the burning house, is the world. The children are the people of the world who are unaware of the danger in the world, the suffering of the world. The father is the Buddha, and the carts are the various vehicles, the various yana, the Shravaka yana, the Pratyeka Buddha yana, and the Bodhisattva yana, or the Buddha yana, if you like. And the best of these, of course, is the Buddha yana. So when the children are out of the house, at that point the Buddha doesn't bother anymore about making distinctions. Because of his impartiality, because of his love for all his children, he gives them all the best carriage, the highest of the yanas, the highest of the vehicles, the vehicle that will lead to Buddhahood, that will enable them to become Buddhas. So once again here we have an example of the working of skill in means. The Buddha uses the device of the various carriages in order to induce his children to abandon the burning house and to come out. And once they're out, he gives them all the very best carriage, the carriage that will take them to Buddhahood. So this is the message contained in the parable of the burning house. Now some people say, well, why did the Buddha bother to teach the quote-unquote Hinayana? Why didn't he teach only the Mahayana? Why did the Buddha teach both Hinayana and Mahayana? The answer to the question is that he taught both the Hinayana and Mahayana because if he taught only the Hinayana or only the Theravada, as you like, as you prefer, Theravada of course is a less loaded word. Unfortunately, Theravada only refers to the Buddhism of the countries of Southeast Asia. It doesn't really refer to the non-Mahayana schools or traditions of India. But be that as it may, why did the Buddha not teach only the lower vehicle or whatever you want to call it? He did not teach only the lower vehicle because then those persons who had the aptitude, who had the ambition to become Buddhas, would have been excluded. And at the same time, he didn't teach only the Mahayana, he didn't teach only the Buddha vehicle, because in that case, some people would have become discouraged. Some people would have thought, oh, this is too much work to become a Buddha, this is too difficult. And so they wouldn't have practiced at all. So the point is that the Buddha taught the so-called lower vehicle, he taught it as an intermediate stage. He taught it as, because of his understanding of expedient means, he taught the lower vehicle as an entry device, as a way of getting people into the stream, if you like, into the highway leading to enlightenment and Buddhahood. And he taught it as a provisional step. And now at this point, we come to a very interesting aspect of the Lotus Sutra and of the Mahayana in general. But one aspect that is particularly stressed in the Lotus Sutra, and that is what becomes of the arhats? What happens to the arhats? What happens to those who practice the Shravakayana, who practice the way of the arhat, and who believe that they achieved nirvana, believe that they achieved extinction? What happens to them? Well, surprise, surprise, they all become Buddhas. Eventually, all the arhats are destined to become Buddhas. And you'll see tomorrow when we review the parable of the burning house, when we look in detail at that third chapter of the Lotus Sutra, you will see that Sariputra and the other arhats all receive predictions to Buddhahood. And they're all told that you will become a Buddha. Your attainment of arhatship, you fancied that you became an arhat, you believed that you had gained extinction, but in fact you were always destined to become a Buddha. This attainment of arhatship was just an intermediate or a temporary stage. And in fact, in another chapter of the sutra, the Buddha talks about an illusory city, a magically created city. And he gives the following example. Again, we have a simile, we have a parable. We have the teaching conveyed by means of a parable. And the Buddha says, suppose there's a guide who is in charge of leading a group of travelers to a far-off place, to a place of great treasure, to a place of great wonder, of great marvels. But the way is long, and the way is tiresome. And along the way, some of the travelers get tired. Some of the travelers get weary. They don't want to go on. And so the guide says, never mind, we're almost there, just a little way ahead there is a marvelous city. That is where we're going. And so he leads the tired and weary travelers. The guide leads them to this marvelous city. Now this marvelous city is an illusion. It's a magical creation. It's a creation of the Tathagata, just as the Tathagata can create, just as the Buddha can create Buddha lands. He can create manifestations of himself, can create manifestations of other living beings. In the same way, he can create magically, through his magical powers, he can create a city, an entire city with all the necessities. In this case, you could say that this illusory city is something like the most wonderful resort that you could ever imagine. And so the tired and weary travelers, they arrive at the city, they rest, they relax, they sleep, they restore their energy, they restore their health, they restore their strength. And then at that point, the guide says, well, actually the real goal is not the city. The real goal is a little bit further on. We have to go a bit further. But by that time, the travelers are ready to follow him again because their strength has been restored, their energy has been restored, they've rested, and so they're ready to go on. So according to the Lotus Sutra, the attainment of arhatship is like reaching this illusory city. It's a kind of resting place, a kind of halfway house on the way to Buddhahood for those people who get tired, who don't feel able to go all the way to Buddhahood. There is this illusory city, this magically created city that we call arhatship, and there these people can rest for a while until their strength is recovered, until they again feel capable to make an effort, an additional effort, and to gain Buddhahood. So all the arhats will eventually become Buddhas. Their sojourn, their stay in the state of arhatship, in the attainment of arhatship, is just a resting period, just a place for relaxation and recovery of their strength. And once they are rested and recovered, they will go on to become Buddhas. So all the arhats will become Buddhas. So eventually, the three vehicles are really only one. All of the beings who practice and attain the lower realizations will eventually become Buddhas. The sutra is full of all these kinds of examples. In another chapter of the sutra, we find the story of the lost son of a very wealthy landowner. This landowner loses his son at a very young age because of certain circumstances. The son is lost, the father is unable to locate the son. But he never gives up looking for his son. And one day, after many years have passed, the father recognizes his son at a distance, far off. And he recognizes his son and he tells his servants, he tells his employees, go and bring that person to me. That person is my son. And so the servants chase after this person and bring him to the father. But the son is in very bad condition. He's very poor. He's very unused to being treated well, and so he's afraid. He's very, very afraid. He thinks that maybe he has been accused of a theft or a crime or something like that. So he's terrified. He tries to run away. The father, seeing the situation, says, all right, let him go. So his servants let this man go, the person that the father had recognized as his long-lost son. They let him go. The father lets a little time elapse. He lets a few days or weeks go by. And then he sends some of his servants, very modestly dressed poorly. He sends his servants to his son, and he offers him a job sweeping out the manure from the cow sheds. And so the son accepts the job, and he comes to work cleaning out the barn and the cow sheds and the horse sheds and so forth. He takes on this job. He's paid very gradually by stages. His responsibilities are increased. His salary is increased slowly over the course of several years. He becomes manager of all the livestock, then he becomes manager or foreman of the whole farm, of the whole establishment. He becomes the head man of the whole establishment, so to speak, the second in charge after the owner, after the master. When he's reached that point, when he's worked for some years in that capacity, when he's come to appreciate his own worth, his own abilities, at that point the father reveals to him, the father says to him, you know, as a matter of fact, you are my son. All this property is yours. It belongs to you. Now, at that point, the son is able to accept this. Gradually, through working first, cleaning out the cow sheds, then being given gradually additional responsibilities, finally being put in charge of the whole enterprise. At this point, the son is able to understand this. He's able to accept the fact that he is indeed the son of the master, of the owner of this great property. And so at that point, the master says to him, you are my son and you will inherit this great property. So the moral of the story here, the message of the parable is, we are all sons of the Buddha. We're all destined to become Buddhas. We don't think we are capable of becoming Buddhas because we lack in self-confidence. We lack in belief in our own worth, in our own capacities. We have been lost for so long in samsara. We have been associated for so long with unworthy and mean conditions and mean attitudes and mean ways of life that we can't imagine. We can't think of becoming Buddhas. But gradually, by practice, by association with the Dharma, gradually we can develop that aspiration, that confidence that we too can become Buddhas. And in reality, we are all sons of the Buddha. We are all truly entitled to this inheritance of Buddhahood. It's only a question of preparing ourselves by means of stages. And in order to prepare us by stages, gradually, step by step, the Buddha devises these expedient means. So this, again, illustrates the practice of skillful means, the practice of expedient means. The father, the owner of that great property, of that great farm, he understood that his son was not able to appreciate his real identity. He wasn't able to appreciate his worth, he wasn't able to accept his inheritance. So he gradually, step by step, brings him along, cultivates his potential until such a point at which he can realize and he can accept that he is a son of the Master, that he is a son of the Buddha, that he too is entitled to this inheritance of Buddhahood, to this inheritance of enlightenment. So in this sense, the message of the Sutta, the message of the Lotus Sutra is very positive. It's a universal message. It's a message for everyone. Everyone can become a Buddha. It only takes the right means. It only takes the right road, the right methods, the right practices to follow. But everyone has got the potential to become a Buddha. Everyone is a son of the Buddha. Everyone can eventually realize Buddhahood and gain ultimate, supreme, perfect enlightenment with all the attributes and all the qualities of Buddhahood. So this is the idea of great compassion, the great compassion of the Buddha expressing itself through skill and means and helping all living beings step by step, by stages, sometimes by detours, by circular courses, circular patterns, circular paths, but all the time having in mind the objective, the end of attaining Buddhahood, the end of attaining the highest and most perfect enlightenment. So this is the message that the sutra conveys throughout with the help of these parables, with the use of these similes, in order to show that by the application of skill and means, by the use of skill and means, born of great compassion of the Buddha, all living beings can be brought along to the point at which they achieve Buddhahood. They're able to achieve Buddhahood. Now, I want to say that here we have a very different conception of what is meant by the Buddha. When in Mahayana circles, in the Mahayana tradition, when the Mahayana refers to the Buddha, the Mahayana is not referring primarily to the Buddha Shakyamuni. When the Mahayana refers to the conception of the Buddha, it is really referring to what I sometimes call a kind of enlightenment energy, a kind of principle of enlightenment. And I say this with a certain amount of hesitation because I don't want to appear to be giving voice to some kind of New Age theory about an enlightened principle or an enlightenment energy or something like that. But the fact is that for the Mahayana, the Buddha is universal, transcendental, inconceivable, inexpressible. He has no limits. He has inconceivable qualities, inconceivable powers. Now, when we speak about Buddha in that sense, the Buddha is beyond all names. He's beyond all personalities. The Buddha is a force, so to speak. The Buddha is a presence. It is a presence that manifests itself in various forms, in various personalities. You see, later on we will talk in more detail about the Mahayana conception of the dimensions of Buddhahood. We already said yesterday when we were reviewing the Theravada texts that there was from the very beginning a kind of association between the Buddha Shakyamuni and the Dharma, that there was already a suggestion that the Dharma was in fact the Buddha, that the Buddha was in fact the Dharma. And this is an early, a very early, or a very it is the germ of the idea which is very common in the Mahayana tradition, the idea of the aspects or dimensions of the Buddha. And one of the dimensions of the Buddha is what we refer to as the Dharmakaya, or the transcendental dimension of Buddhahood. Now, this transcendental dimension, this Dharmakaya of the Buddha, this is beyond all conceptions and all expressions. It's beyond names, thought, it's beyond forms. It is the Dharmakaya, it is transcendental dimension. In that sense, the Dharmakaya of all the Buddhas is identical. There is no distinction in the Dharmakaya of all the Buddhas that we have heard of or may hear of, or all the Buddhas that have existed in the past, all the Buddhas that will come in the future. Their transcendental dimension, their Dharmakaya, is identical, because you cannot draw distinctions, you cannot make distinctions in the Dharmakaya. The Dharmakaya is transcendental, it is beyond expression, it is beyond names, it is beyond forms. So in that sense, the Dharmakaya of the Buddha Shakyamuni, the Dharmakaya of the Buddha Dipankara, the Dharmakaya of the Buddha Vipassin, the Dharmakaya of all the Buddhas, of all the three times, past, present and future, the Dharmakaya of all these Buddhas is identical. What is different is their terrestrial appearance, their appearance in the world as Dipankara, as Shakyamuni, as the other Buddhas that belong to particular ages. Their differences occur on the level of their heavenly appearances, so that in that sense, when I said this morning that the Buddha Shakyamuni actually even now is teaching the Dharma on the Vulture Peak in India, that would be the heavenly or the celestial dimension of Buddhahood, the celestial dimension of the Buddha Shakyamuni. When we say celestial dimension, we mean that it is available only to those who have purified insights. Only those people can see him. If you or I, if ordinary people go to the Vulture Peak in India, we won't see the Buddha Shakyamuni teaching the Dharma. But in the pure vision, with purified eyes, with eyes of enlightenment, with eyes of one who has achieved the first stage on the Bodhisattva path, with this sort of enhanced spiritual vision, it is possible to see the Buddha Shakyamuni even now teaching the Dharma on the Vulture Peak. So these appearances of Buddha are appearances that are limited to time and place. The more impure the spiritual eyes, the more impaired the faculties of the disciples are, the more limited the appearances of the transcendental Buddha are. So, for example, for those of relatively limited vision, those of relatively impure perception, the Buddha appeared as Shakyamuni, the transcendental, eternal Buddha appeared in the form of Shakyamuni, lived, died in the 6th century BC, and during that period, a lot of people who were ordinary people without any particular spiritual development, without any particular emancipation, except that, of course, they all enjoyed very good karma, which enabled them to be born during the time in which this terrestrial, this earthly appearance of the Buddha occurred. But they were not people necessarily specially gifted. And you can understand from the story that I told you yesterday that even when the Buddha was walking among the people of Magadha, among the people of North India, that even then, even when the Buddha was present, physically present, there were people who did not recognize him. People who did not see him. The ascetic who spent the night in the cowshed with him failed to see the Buddha. The Ajivika, the one of the first people that the Buddha met after his enlightenment, when he started out on his way to Banaras to teach the first five monks, one of the first people that the Buddha met was a certain Ajivika, a member of another ascetic sect, a certain Ajivika by the name of Upaka. And he met Upaka on the path. And Upaka said, "My friend, your faculties appear clear, your complexion is bright. What teacher do you study under? What is your path?" And the Buddha said, "I have no teacher. I am the Tathagata. I am the fully awakened one. I am self-realized. I am the enlightened one." And Upaka said, "That may be, my friend." And he took a side road. So even when the Buddha appeared in flesh and blood, in the form, in embodied, present in a psychophysical form, having the five aggregates, appearing in the form of a being endowed with the five aggregates, even then not everyone recognized him. Even then not everyone saw him. So seeing the Buddha, not seeing the Buddha, is a matter of our capacity. It's a matter of our purity. It's a matter of the clarity of our own vision, the purity of our own minds. The Buddha is always there. The Buddha is eternally present. And the Buddha can manifest himself in countless forms. So from the Mahayana point of view, although the Buddha Shakyamuni is the most important manifestation in our age of the eternal Buddha, the transcendental Buddha, the Buddha Shakyamuni is still only one of many manifestations of the Buddha. And the eternal Buddha is capable of infinite manifestations and infinite appearances for the purpose of emancipating living beings. So this is the great difference in the views of the Theravada and the Mahayana with regard to the nature of the Buddha. In the Theravada, although the Buddha has extraordinary powers, although the Buddha is a supermundane being, yet in general it is thought that the Buddha does enter into parinirvana, that the Buddha no longer exists. This is actually somewhat perplexing. It's somewhat perplexing given even the discourses that you heard this morning, discourses that are contained in the Pali text, and discourses where it is specifically said that we cannot talk about the Buddha, the Tathagata, being non-existent after death. We cannot talk about the Buddha ceasing to exist after death. To say that the Tathagata does not exist after death is a mistake. The point being that the categories of existence, non-existence, both existence, and neither existence nor non-existence do not apply to the Buddha, because the Buddha is a transcendental being. As a matter of fact, the categories existence and non-existence don't apply even to the Buddha in this life, even to the Buddha when he appears, when he manifested himself in the 6th century BC, even then one could not say that the Tathagata existed or did not exist. So to believe, to assume, to think that the Buddha has ceased to exist seems to be in direct contradiction to the Buddha's own statements, where he refuses to accept the idea that becoming a Tathagata, abandoning the aggregates, abandoning the psychophysical form, that this is tantamount to existence. There's another discourse which I mentioned yesterday, which we didn't have a chance to review this morning. That is the Yamaka Sutta. The Yamaka Sutta is to do with a monk who formulates the idea that once an enlightened one gives up the aggregates, he is completely annihilated and destroyed and non-existent. And the monks try to persuade him to abandon this view, and he refuses to abandon it. And so they go, finally, in desperation, they go to Shariputra, and they say to Shariputra, please go and have a talk with Yamaka, who has this evil notion, who has this mistaken idea that when an enlightened person abandons the aggregates, abandons the psychophysical elements of personality, that then he becomes annihilated, that then he totally ceases to exist. Go and talk to him. Prize him away from this evil view, from this evil supposition. And so Sariputra goes and talks to Yamaka, and he tells Yamaka, is the Tathagata identical with form? Is the Tathagata different from form? Is the Tathagata identical with feeling? Is he different from feeling? In other words, is the Tathagata identical with or different from the five aggregates? And of course the answer to that is no. The Tathagata is not identical with the five aggregates, and he's also not different. So you can't pin down the Tathagata even in this life. So how can you say that when the aggregates are abandoned, when the aggregates are given up, that the Tathagata ceases to exist, that the Tathagata is annihilated? So the point that the Mahayana is trying to make, and it is a point which is in many ways very close and entirely faithful to the spirit of the teachings of the Buddha, even as we find them in the Pali Canon, the fact that the Buddha cannot be pinned down, that we cannot say of the Buddha that he exists or he doesn't exist, or that he both exists and does not exist, or that he neither exists nor does not exist, that the Buddha is inconceivable, that the Buddha is unfathomable, boundless. He's boundless like the great ocean. He cannot be traced. He cannot be tracked down. The nature of the Buddha is such that he is not subject to these limiting definitions, to these limiting predications of existence, non-existence, and so forth. So we have here a view of the Buddha which recognizes the inconceivable, inexpressible, transcendental magnificence of the Buddha. The fact that the Buddha is the source of all light in the world, in a sense. We have the poem by Edward Arnold called The Light of Asia. The Buddha was not only the light of Asia. The Buddha was the light of the world, is still the light of the world. The Buddha, in this sense, is what enables all living beings to aspire to enlightenment, to aspire to emancipation, to aspire to achieve a goal which is exalted, sublime, beyond anything offered by any other religion. I was saying the other day, Christianity does not allow you to become Jesus, let alone God. The ideal of the Hindus, the ideal of the Jivan Atman, the liberated self, The ideal of the liberated self is someone who disappears, who lives his life and then disappears. And if we think of the goal of Buddhism as to achieve nirvana, to become annihilated, to disappear into nirvana, to become extinct, to enter into extinction, then the goal of Buddhism is also very limited, and people have some justification in referring to Buddhism as being negative or as having a nihilistic outcome. But this is not the goal of Buddhism according to Mahayana. The goal of Buddhism according to Mahayana is to become a Buddha, to become an enlightened being, a person who will be always present in the world, who will be always there to help living beings, who will be there to be a bridge for them when they need a bridge, to be food for them when they're hungry, to be medicine for them when they're sick, and to lead them gradually, step by step, toward enlightenment, to free all living beings from samsara. This is the goal of the Mahayana. This is the goal of Buddhism according to the Mahayana text. This is what the Lotus Sutra is preaching. The Lotus Sutra is saying, look at this marvelous, inconceivable, unimaginable energy, being, reality that we call the Buddha. And look at what he's capable of. Look at how he can lead countless living beings to enlightenment, how he can devise the methods, the means that are appropriate for benefiting all these countless living beings and taking them to the ultimate goal of liberation and nirvana, helping them to free themselves step by step from countless lifetimes of imprisonment in samsara, countless lifetimes of affliction and defilement. And that he can do this in countless inconceivable ways. We cannot understand, we cannot appreciate the diversity and the subtlety of the Buddha's liberating activity. We can only guess at it. So a famous Mahayana master by the name of Chandrakirti, who wrote a text about the Bodhisattva way and the stages of the Bodhisattva, and he came to the final stage, to the stage of Buddhahood, and he describes the qualities of Buddhahood for a number of pages, and then he stops. He stops and he says, I can't. I will stop at this point to describe the qualities of Buddhahood, not because I've come to the end of the qualities of the Buddha, but because my strength is at an end. I can't describe any more of the qualities of the Buddha. I am like a bird. A bird stops. A bird stops flying, not because he comes to the end of the sky. A bird stops flying because he has no more strength to fly any further. And my situation is similar. I stop describing the qualities of the Buddha, not because the qualities of the Buddha are at an end, because I've come to the end of the qualities of the Buddha, but because my strength to describe them has come to an end. So for that reason, I will stop at this point. I cannot describe, I cannot retell any more of the qualities of the Buddha. So what we have in the Lotus Sutra, particularly because among all the Mahayana texts, the Lotus Sutra is primarily concerned with describing the majesty of the Buddha. In the Lotus Sutra, we have this revelation, this disclosure of a conception of Buddhahood which is far grander than anything we had before. We begin to appreciate the greatness of the Buddha in certain passages of the Pali texts. we begin to understand the greatness of the Buddha in Sanskrit texts like the Lalita Vistara and so on. But in the Lotus Sutra, we really find the full majesty of the Buddha disclosed. And following upon the Lotus Sutra, great masters like Aryanagarjuna, for example, whom I quoted at the beginning of today's talks, at the beginning of my lectures on the Lotus Sutra, when I said that Nagarjuna says, do not disparage the Mahayana, because its motivation is compassion. It's based on compassion. Nagarjuna also says, let the majesty of the Buddha be accepted. Let us accept the fact that the Buddha is endowed with immeasurable, inconceivable qualities, immeasurable, inconceivable attributes. Let his majesty, let his greatness be acknowledged. Let it be admitted. So I think the point with which I would like to end this afternoon, and perhaps today we may have a few minutes for questions. We haven't had time for questions, which is unfortunate. But the point that I would like to end with is that with the appearance of the Lotus Sutra and with the appearance of the Mahayana, we have a really greatly enhanced vision of the Buddha. A vision of the Buddha which transcends, which goes far beyond the notions of a Buddha as a perfected man, as a moral teacher, as a teacher of morality, as a teacher of ethics, that goes beyond the conception of the Buddha as someone who was a great meditator, as someone who had a profound insight into the nature of reality. The Buddha was all that, but the Buddha was also countless things that we can't even begin to imagine. We can't even begin to imagine. There are limits to our own vision. We can't see the ends of the universe. We can't even see the sea from where we are just now, although I suppose the sea is not very far off. And certainly we cannot see all the qualities and all the attributes and all the majesty of the Buddha. We can only imagine it. We can only imagine it. But we do not do the Buddha nor Buddhism any service by reducing the Buddha to the measure of our vision. It is not just, it is not right that we should cut the Buddha down to size just as if we had a very big photograph and we can't put it into our frame, and so we cut away two-thirds, three-quarters, who knows how much of the photograph, how much of the reality. We discard the reality, the greatness, so much of the greatness, so much of the inconceivable qualities of the Buddha, because we don't understand them and we only grasp at those few qualities that we can understand, those few aspects of the Buddha's being that we can pin down. And the ones that we can't pin down, we ignore. And that's our loss. It doesn't matter to the Buddha. The Buddha is there working for the liberation of all of us. But we make our vision of the Buddha poorer by refusing to admit, refusing to accept that the Buddha is far greater than what we can even begin to imagine. Okay, let me stop at this point. If there are questions, please feel free. There are a few minutes left today.
Using of the
The abusing of compassion.
Yeah.
Yes. In order for compassion to operate successfully, it has to operate together with wisdom. Compassion without wisdom can get not only you into trouble, but it can get the people that you are trying to help into trouble. Therefore, it has to go hand in hand with wisdom. But I can't teach everything at once. I have to teach step by step. So today I concentrated on compassion. Now when we look at the perfection of wisdom discourses and the Prajnaparamita, Hridaya Sutra and other texts that belong to the perfection of wisdom teachings, then we will learn a little bit about wisdom and we will see how wisdom has to go hand in hand with compassion. Compassion without wisdom is just clumsy meddling. What is happening here in this classroom? What is happening at the IBC? I mean, this is part of Buddha's activities. Every time somebody comes up with the idea that I should work for other living beings, that I should try to help other living beings, every time that someone comes up with an unselfish thought, every time that someone comes up with a thought of loving kindness toward other living beings, every time that people decide not to retaliate, not to be violent, but to be patient, everything virtuous and positive that we do is an expression, a manifestation of the Buddha's activities. The presence of the Buddha in the world is responsible for everything that is peaceful and positive and that strives for understanding, that strives for knowledge. These are all expressions of the Buddha, the manifestations of the Buddha activity. You might say, well, there's a lot of things that are not positive in the world, a lot of negative things. Those are, you know, are those the Buddha activity? Well, that is sometimes difficult to say. There can be events that we perceive as being negative that in the long term may lead to the benefit of living beings. But the fact that the Buddha is active in the world, I think certainly for followers of the Mahayana, I think there's not really any question about that. Whatever we do positively, whatever we do for our own good and for the good of others, this is all the power, the energy that allows us to do this is all Buddha power, it's all Buddha energy. So I would answer the question that way. I don't think that we need to point to any particular event or object and say that is a Buddha activity. The Buddha activity is everywhere and it's everywhere present. Well, certainly the one good thing about Christianity, of course, is that it does teach people to love their neighbors, and it teaches people to be unselfish and so forth. But the fact is that it's a completely different, this is a coincidence a minor coincidence in the middle of a sea of differences, in the sense that the Christian conception, apart from this inclination toward altruism, this teaching about loving your neighbor as yourself and so forth, which incidentally is not so very different from other traditions. The morality of all the religions, all the major religions, is relatively similar. You know, Confucius also said, do not treat other people the way you would not want them to treat you. Buddhism says the same thing. Christianity says, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. The emphasis on love and so forth in Christianity is somewhat similar, but let me put it this way. For one thing, the Christian love tends to be somewhat condescending. I am saved, you are not, you poor thing, I should save you, you know? Buddhists, I don't think, take that attitude. Buddhists take the attitude, none of us are saved, we're all in the same boat, let's help each other, you know? I think that's more descriptive of the Buddhist tendency. Then there are so many other differences, you know? The bottom line in Christianity is faith in Jesus. You can be an awful person, you can be a terrible person, you can commit endless crimes. If you develop faith in Jesus just before you die, if you get the moment right, no? If you don't leave it too late, and you develop faith in Jesus 5 seconds before you die, you go to heaven. Even if you've killed hundreds of people and been an awful person, you know? So there are very fundamental flaws in Christian philosophy and Christian religion, which is why I gave up Christianity when I was 13, because it just has too many defects. It has some precious nuggets like love your neighbor as yourself and so forth, but it has too many defects. And so I think that, you know, the Christians, I've heard them say, oh, the problem with Buddhism is it has no love and compassion. Well, I wish they would, you know, what about even the Brahma Viharas, you know, where you meditate love and compassion. The Christians like to say that, you know, Buddhism has no love and compassion. This is nonsense. Christianity does teach love, which is great. But Christianity has also been personally or directly responsible for some of the most brutal oppression and conflicts ever to take place in the world, beginning with the Crusades, continuing with the colonization of Latin America. Buddhism, fortunately, a lot of crimes have been committed by Buddhists, but not by Buddhism. Not in the name of Buddhism. So I think that, you know, it's not really justifiable to point a finger at the Mahayana and criticize it because it's like Christianity.
Is the question is answered? You said something about they believe that Jesus in oneself.
Yeah. Well, of course, we all believe that we are all potentially, the Mahayana believes we are all potentially Buddhists. But, I mean, that we're all potentially Buddhas. You know, that the potentiality to become a Buddha is within us, and that Buddha is within our hearts, within our minds. But that's a different thing in the sense that, first, it's different for one thing, because Buddha and Jesus are very different figures. You know, so for that reason, it's different. Secondly, it's also different because we think that the potential to become a Buddha is within us, that the Buddha seed, we're going to talk about this in more detail tomorrow or the day after, but the Buddha nature is within us, but that has to be developed. That's not something that is just a gift. It's not something that we can just achieve by saying, we have faith in the Buddha, therefore the Buddha is within us. The Buddha is within us by nature. naturally the Buddha is within us. We have the inherent, the natural potential to become Buddhas, but we have to develop that.
Excuse me. According to the Lotus Sutra, you explain about the Buddhayana, Sravayana, I have some confusion because who become Arahanta, they also after become will become Buddhahood, you explain. But according to the Aryaparayana Sutra and other Aragatsuguru Sutra, who become Arahanta, actually they never come again. That means the Aryaparayana Sutra Buddha say, Abhavita Devata Amatasya Dwara, Amatasya meaning Amata, meaning deathless.
Yeah.
Deathless. Amatasya Dwara. I open the Nibbana, Amatasya Dwara, deathless. I open the door of the deathless. The other thing, Tagakke, Dosakke, Mohakke, Idamutit Nibbana. Nibbana explained, who can fully destroy the lust, hatred, and ignorance. They become Nibbana. That means actually Nibbana means not rebirth. According to explanation of the Lotus Sutra, I have some confusion.
Yes, but I think that this can be reconciled. I mean, you say that the Aryaparayana Sutra talks about the deathless, and of course, I mean that Sariputra attained arahatship and he attained the deathless. That's why he was still able to attain Buddhahood, because he did not die. He was still there to attain Buddhahood. So to say that the arahants attain the deathless doesn't close the door to their eventual attaining of Buddhahood. And as far as rebirth is concerned, nobody claims that the Buddhas or the arahants are reborn in the conventional, in the ordinary way, the way that we are reborn, compelled by karma, that we are forced to take this birth and that birth, and we continue to circle in samsara. What the Mahayana is saying, that after liberation, you can have a spontaneous, magical, if you like to call it, a magical appearance in the world, and it will appear like a normal birth and so forth, but it does not involve you. That birth is not conditioned by karma, and that birth is not forced. That birth is a voluntary appearance in the world in order to benefit living beings. So there's a difference between rebirth as it happens to ordinary living beings, conditioned by karma and by the afflictions, and the appearance in the world of enlightened living beings who appear not because they have to, but because they have made a vow to help to liberate other living beings. So it's a voluntary manifestation in the world. It's not a compelled or a forced rebirth in the world. So these are distinctions that are important, and they help to be able to bridge the gap between the kind of statements that you find regarding nirvana being the end of all rebirth and so forth. It is the end of rebirth in the normal sense of the term. It doesn't necessarily mean extinction. It doesn't necessarily mean that there is no further appearance. And for every statement to the effect that nirvana is extinction, you can find all of these declarations that you cannot say of the enlightened monk that he is annihilated after the breaking up of the body. So if he's not annihilated, the door is still open for some kind of activity. Um, According to the Lotus Sutra, attaining nirvana is just a sort of resort. It's a rest and recuperation state. And that eventually the arhats will go on to follow the bodhisattva path. Now, there are some texts, even Mahayana texts, that say no. If you become an arhat, you can't become a Buddha. You just end up stuck in this state of arhatship. So there is some disagreement even within the Mahayana tradition about whether or not all the arhats will become Buddhas. Lotus Sutra is very clear. Lotus Sutra says all the arhats will eventually become Buddhas. Some other Mahayana sutras, which actually I think are more sectarian, if you like, some other Mahayana texts say that watch out, don't follow the Theravada path, don't follow the Hinayana path, because you're going to become an arhat and then you're going to be stuck in arhatship eternally. So beware of following the Theravada path. Lotus Sutra is more sort of liberal. It says, don't worry, you can follow the Theravada path and become an arhat. You don't, by that, you don't necessarily surrender your chance of becoming a Buddha. So there is some difference of opinion regarding these statements. As I said at the beginning of this course, we have to be patient. We can't expect to understand everything immediately. And the Dharma is very deep and very profound, and the Buddha, according to all the traditions, Theravada, Mahayana, whichever one you care to look at, the Buddha's teaching was difficult to understand, the Dharma is difficult to understand, and so there are certain aspects that will remain a problem for some of us. We can't pretend to eliminate all the problems and all the apparent contradictions. But I'll just remind you of something that was said not by a Buddhist master or saint, but it was said by Albert Einstein, and he said that problems, the solutions to problems are almost never found at the level at which the problem presents itself. So, in other words, in order to resolve certain problems, we have to also raise ourselves to a higher level. We have to gain a higher or a more comprehensive perspective. And that we can only do by listening, by thinking about the Dharma, and by meditating. And gradually we will understand things that we didn't understand initially. I've been involved in Buddhist studies for 35 years. There's still many things that I don't understand. There were many, many more things that I didn't understand 35 years ago, or 30 years ago, or 25 years ago. Gradually, as your practice and your study deepen, you understand more and more. But it would be foolish and pretentious to expect to understand everything, even in the course of one lifetime. Hardly. We don't have a lot of documentation of that sort. The fact is that we had a kind of schism, which was not a philosophical schism, but a geographical schism more than anything else. We had contact between the Mahayana and the Stavitavada in India up until the 4th, 5th, 6th centuries. We do have some debates in Indian literature, some texts that deal with the discussion. For example, when we come in the second part of this course, when we come to look at the works of Nagarjuna, there we will see a certain polemic, a certain documentation of the disagreements between the Mahayana and the Theravada points of view with regard to the nature of nirvana, with regard to the nature of interdependent origination and so forth. We do have some documents. I personally am not aware of any document in Pali that directly refutes or attempts to refute or attacks the Mahayana. I'm not primarily a Pali scholar. I've done most of my work with Sanskrit and Tibetan sources. One of you people who are more conversant with Pali, if there is such a text, or maybe when some learned Pali scholar visits, you might ask him. I would be very interested to see a text in Pali attacking the Mahayana. I am personally am not aware of any. Not the Mahayana. They have the Katavatu of the Abhidharma is of course a record of the debates between the non-Mahayana schools. So there are debates between the Vasiputriyas and the Sarvastivadins and Vibhajavadins and so forth. But the Mahayanas are not mentioned in that text. So I think that any Pali text attacking directly the Mahayana or attempting to refute the Mahayana would have to be post-Common Era. We don't have, for example, in Buddha Ghosha's Visuddhimagga, we don't have any direct attack or criticism of the Mahayana, which is, you know, in a sense this is strange. One might expect something to be there, since this is a relatively late text. We don't have it. What?
Finished?
Finished?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, then we'll see you tomorrow.